I'm Catherine Arndt, the Chief of the VLGA Connect Studio. Welcome to today's episode, brought to you by the VLGA, your councillor support network and the national broadcaster on all things local government.
Hi everyone, it's TGU time. That stands for the Governance Update from VLGA Connect, which is brought to you by Hunt & Hunt Lawyers and the VLGA, of course. And I've got good news, bad news, and more good news to start off the show today. The good news is that Tony Rounick is here. Hi, Tony.
Hi, Chris. Good to see you again.
Good to have you back. I hope you've had a good and busy and productive week.
Oh, absolutely. Every week, Chris. They're all
excellent.
Productive.
Excellent. Not surprised. The bad news, Julie Reed is a bit under the weather and can't join us on this week's program. We wish Julie well and hope she'll be back with us very soon. But there's good news to offset the bad news, and we're delighted to have joining us again on the panel this week, Kendria Pope. Hello, Kendria.
Chris, hi, Tony. Nice to see you again, and thanks for having me back.
No, nice to have you back. Your insights into some of the governance issues we discussed last time were terrific, and we'd love to hear your thoughts on a few of the issues that are doing the rounds this week as well. And there's no shortage, Kendria and Tony. This week we've had another municipal monitor announcement. This one relates to Glenelg Shire, where two monitors, Jim Gifford and Stephen Kingshott, were appointed back in November for a three-month term. That term's completed. They've submitted their final report to the minister. I know Tony's got some thoughts on what's in that final report, which has been released. But of course, now those two monitors have been reappointed for different terms. This is interesting. Bear with me. So Steve Kingshott is reappointed until, I think it's 4 weeks after the appointment of a chief executive officer. So that's to help oversee that CEO appointment process. Jim Gifford will remain in place until the end of December. That's to see through the election period and the commencement of a new group of elected councillors. Tony, your thoughts firstly on the reappointment.
As you say, interesting seeing those different terms for the new reappointments with Jim Gifford, you know, extending beyond the council elections, and clearly the view that, you know, it's going to be really critical, the appointment of a new CEO, and because, you know, Mr. Kingshott will stay in his position to that point in 4 weeks beyond. Probably useful to reflect on why monitors were appointed in the first place back in November 23, and that was following a request from the then mayor at Glenelg, which followed the resignation of the then CEO, Paul Phelan, and two of the sitting councillors, Chrissy Hawker and Jaden Smith, that, you know, led the then mayor to write to the minister and ask for that this intervention. And the report's quite detailed and does actually shed some light on the background, if you like, to some of the incidents that led to concerns about governance. And there was the, I'll call it the Portland Christmas lights saga, yes. Kendria, yes. And Chris, which was, I guess, to use a lights analogy, it was about the Christmas lights initially being sort of intended to be switched off, and then they got switched back on again, in that there was a councillor workshop, and remember that word workshop, because that's going to be important as we go through this report, but a councillor workshop where council officers presented to councillors a proposal that for the festive season 2023, there would be a change to the Christmas decorations, New Year's Eve arrangements, and in an effort to save money, given that there were some budgetary constraints, the Bentinck Street, Norfolk Island Pine in Portland, which is traditionally lit up at considerable expense, that wouldn't be lit up was the plan, and that there'd also be some changes to, you know, some of the New Year's Eve festive arrangements. And that was that news was delivered to councillors in the workshop. Apparently, council officer at the time understood that councillors were comfortable with that arrangement. There was a media release in October of 2023, and as the report says, social media lit up like the tree in question after this media release announcing the changes. Lots of disrespectful comments about council, about specific council staff, and of course, many councillors themselves actually coming out publicly criticising the decision, such that there was ultimately a sort of an about face, and the council announced that they would stick with the traditional Christmas decorations arrangements there. There was another major sort of background issue, and that was the 2022 rate rebate decision. So for about 10 years in the Glenelg Shire, landowners whose land was being used for primary production purposes were receiving a 30% rate rebate. So they were officially being rated the same as landowners whose land was being used for residential purposes, but there was this 30% rate rebate. On paper, it was going back to them after they paid, but really what was happening, they were paying 30% less. That all changed following a fairly controversial vote of council in the lead up to the 2022-2023 budget arrangements. I think it was passed on the casting vote of the mayor, and it was a very unpopular move that increased rates significantly for these primary producers in the municipality, and ultimately led to this angst in the community and amongst councillors too. It was quite disruptive in terms of relationships.
So they're the key things that have led to the fracturing of relationships, an environment that obviously had become very difficult for many of the people working within it, both councillors and officers. So what led to the breakdown? We saw the councillors resign, as you mentioned. We saw countback candidates refusing to take up the role. I think the monitors say that was a reflection of the reputation that the council had built in the community over these issues, Tony?
Quite a dramatic reputational impact, I think, on council, such that even council staff were reportedly, you know, removing their council identification, their badges when they were going out in the public, you know, not wanting to be, publicly, criticised, given that the council was on the nose a little, if you like, in the public at the time. But what I found really interesting too, Chris and Kendria, was the monitors' identification, the two monitors, of identifying various governance concerns they have with, you know, current arrangements that they found at council when they arrived. And one was this notion of these monthly workshops. And workshops, keyword, we understand this notion of councillors regularly meeting with often senior council officers in a non-public setting, and traditionally called council briefings or council, that's one of the words. But this notion of a workshop being like working things through to a conclusion or an outcome, the monitors saw that as problematic. What was happening was often this was a forum for councillors to be directing council staff about decisions being made under delegation, about recommendations that staff were planning to put forward in a council meeting. They were sort of being road tested in these workshops, and sometimes, ultimately the recommendation would change, it would seem, given the feedback of councillors. So it's clearly a transparency issue in terms of the public seeing how decisions were being made. And the monitors ultimately have taken issue with these workshops and recommended that they be replaced under new governance rules with councillor briefings whose purpose would be only to, you know, share information, and decision-making being expressly prohibited in those forums, and reports of those briefings be provided at each forthcoming council meeting. It's a major change in the way they sort of made decisions. Clearly, a problematic approach had, it would appear to have been conducted at Glenelg for some time.
Yeah, obviously it's a concern if decisions are being taken away from workshops and implemented without the council formally making that decision at an ordinary council meeting. So Tony, were they having workshops as well as briefing sessions, as well as ordinary council meetings, or not the traditional briefing session? Kendry, I'll come to you in just a sec. Not the traditional briefing session that other councils are known to have?
Yeah, my impression was that it was this workshop forum that was the key forum, and it wasn't something like you describe as a briefing. And maybe it's just how their briefings evolved to become this workshop forum. But yeah. As you say, clearly not consistent with VAGO reports and that we've seen over the years that talk about the importance of a transparency of decision-making at councils.
And I think it's probably also useful to think about the range of recommendations that the monitors previously made. So I think they developed up a 5-point plan that was to form a work program which would guide the council towards better governance over time. And I would hope that they've improved the practice that Tony's just referred to, because that would seem something that you could certainly relatively in a straightforward manner resolve pretty quickly. But one of the other areas that they identified for further work was on the renewal of the policies and procedures and practices at council. And I suppose that drew my attention, because I think that there are so many councils that are struggling with what seems like a mountain of policies and procedures that they find very challenging to maintain. And that is an issue that impacts and I think causes many CEOs to lose sleep. It's something that impacts both metro councils, regional councils and rural councils, and would certainly seem an area where there's potential for a slightly different approach. Many councils have hundreds of policies, both council adopted policies and many hundreds of administrative policies, which are frequently inconsistent or overlapping, out of date, and in many cases adding very little value, and in fact potentially detracting from the agency of staff to work within their area of authority. So I think it's a sector-wide problem, and if indeed Glenelg has struggled to update that suite of policies, they wouldn't be alone. But I certainly think, it's something that with some support from the state and with a more joined-up approach across the sector, ideally councils would have access to a suite of really streamlined policies that they could draw upon and potentially tweak to their own needs. And that would resolve a huge issue that faces many councils and is often something that's a priority but never seen as urgent and therefore never, sufficiently addressed and resolved.
We could spend a lot of time on the policy issue, and I've certainly been challenged by this in the past, policies versus procedures. I was just asked the other day by someone for my opinion on a policy that had been endorsed at the senior executive level, but it didn't appear to have been endorsed at the council level. So what sort of authority does that policy carry? And Tony, do you see this often, where there's some confusion about whether a policy has to be adopted formally by a council to have effect?
Yeah, and I think it would turn on what element the policy is dealing with, because clearly, the CEO would have the ability to introduce and mandate, if you like, policies for staff in terms of operational matters, OH&S, these sorts of things. But then when it comes to, the interface with the public, Perhaps councillors might have a greater role there. Yeah, it's a challenge for councils, I think.
I think it's probably, again, one of those things that that could be worked on at a sort of system-wide level. You know, often the very first step is to get your architecture right so that you've clearly defined which areas are the proper areas for council-endorsed policies and council policy making, and then to have that architecture then properly delineate between those areas that are properly within the authority of the administration. Getting that right, you know, is really critical, and it flows, the work program then flows from there.
What do we think about this hybrid approach to monitors? Because it looked like the government was moving towards having a team of two monitors in place, as has happened at Geelong, as happened at Brimbank. Here we've got Mr. Kingshott, who I know it's also been appointed recently as the chair of the Grants Commission, so probably got a lot more on his plate now than when he was first appointed, just for that that period through the CEO, and then the appointment of the CEO, rather, and then Jim Gifford flying solo, if you like, for a number of months through to the end of the year. Should we draw any conclusions from that?
There's some logic to what has been, you know, put in place in terms of the arrangements, the timetable for those two monitors. But I sometimes wonder whether it's design or necessity, whether it's availability of people sometimes too. Look, I think this could work quite well. I think knowing that there is a continuity in terms of a monitor beyond the council elections, I think will be valuable for an incoming group of councillors. But I also see that that having a permanent or, you know, an ongoing CEO appointment would likely mean make a really significant impact on the way the council can run, and would reduce the need, if you like, for that you know, external monitoring, and make sense for there therefore just to be one monitor beyond that point.
Yeah, and I think I agree with what Tony says there. The other thing I suppose I interpret from this is that there's an evolution of the role of monitor and our understanding of how they can fulfil that role. And with that, you might need, in fact, different approaches being brought to any particular set of problems. So, you know, no longer are they just watching, but potentially, you know, there's a really significant role they can play in actually very actively facilitating, you know, the resolution of some of these issues at council. And that requires a somewhat different skill set to a more sort of compliance-oriented or audit style of monitoring, shall we say. So I think, you know, with that evolution of the role and with the complexity of some of the needs in these situations, taking into account all of the technical issues and all of the cultural issues that present and the relationship breakdown that sometimes has occurred, I think that certainly does lend itself to having more than one individual who can bring, you know, their own sort of set of skills and knowledge and experience to part of the solution.
Makes a lot of sense, doesn't it? Anything more to say about the Glenelg report before we move on, Tony?
Yeah, Chris and Kendra, can I think highlight from a sector-wide perspective, I think some of the things that the monitors dealt with in their report really, I think, can have sector-wide implications. Mm-hmm. And the first one would be this notion around public question time. I think they observe that Glenelg Shire Council meetings had been, if you like, sort of dominated by public question time, in that, you know, firstly, there were fairly broad, or lax, if you like, rules on on questions. There was no time limit to how long a question could go for. Each member of the public could ask up to three questions on the night. So they're having all these sort of quite lengthy questions being asked by the same individuals from the community that appeared to be sort of designed to disrupt the meeting and kind of almost change the tone of the meeting right at the start of the meeting. And we often see this in councils. I call these sort of people in the community, like Clayton's councillors. Remember that ad in the 70s for, you know, the Jack Thompson, I think it was, you know, the drink you have when you're not having a drink. These are the people who aren't elected to council, but they're very vocal at council meetings. And the recommendation from the monitors was to implement new governance rules that required, you know, firstly, questions to be lodged in advance. Questions would be read out by the mayor, not by the questioner. But critically, I think question time was to be at the end of council meetings. So it didn't sort of set the tone, but what was something at the conclusion. And I think that that's a takeaway for some councils might want to consider that element. The other one that stood out for me too was the duplicating of administrative processes, where members of the public were putting in service requests and then councillors were duplicating that request. So you've got this inefficiency and an element of sort of councillors sort of dwelling in, you know, getting into the operational. And again, there was quite some critical comments about that practice and some changes that the monitors implemented. And I think another that I'd highlight in terms of across the sector would be dealing with confidential information. Right. And the monitors identified that there was quite some confusion at council following the 2020 Act changes where, you know, we now have a definition in Section 125 of what is confidential information. There remained this confusion at council about, you know, well, what about these other documents that mightn't meet the Section 125 definition, but as a matter of good governance should be kept confidential, like things like working papers or draft documents that were given to councillors in a briefing session. And the recommendation of the monitors was that the CEO going forwards would label such documents commercial in confidence, and the councillor code of conduct would be explicit and say, you know, releasing documents like that without a council resolution would be inappropriate. So just, I guess the pendulum swinging a little bit more towards that prescriptive again. You know, the 2020 Act swung more towards a local base. You work it out for yourself, and councillors work it out. It's in the Act. It's in the definitions. Towards now going back to that notion of the CEO labelling a document so that councillors know, hey, I have to be careful with this document.
I do recall doing an interview with David Wolfe at IBAC, and he made the point that there's a bit of a continuum here where you move towards the principles base and ultimately over time you probably come back to more prescription as issues come up. And I think that's where we're at. You talk about governance rules and councils, of course, can review them and update them at any time. I see Cardinia Shire has just put its amended governance rules out for community comment. And you made the point about perhaps moving community question time later in a meeting so that it doesn't set the tone for the meeting, Tony. I note Cardinia, in its changes, is suggesting bringing community question time forward to benefit community members asking questions at meetings. So, you know, we're not getting a uniform approach to these issues. The other thing I thought was interesting was they're changing their notice period for publishing agendas on the council's website to be 6 days prior to a meeting. I thought it said business days, but it doesn't. 6 days prior to a meeting. Do we have a uniform approach to that even across the sector? I know you look at a lot of governance rules, Kendria, don't you?
I do indeed. And just thinking back on your earlier point, Chris, I can imagine many councils that I've worked with would strongly reject a notion that public question time should be put to the end of a meeting after which all the key decisions have been made. Yeah. But certainly in terms of the uniformity and the timelines for producing agendas, that's it's Very significant challenge for the governance and CEO's office to get those agendas out, and particularly if they're working on a cycle of two meetings per month. It doesn't really give you very long between your briefings, taking on board the feedback and the input of councillors into, you know, your officer report considerations. Doesn't really give you very long to turn those reports around and have them ready for a public agenda. So I can imagine, you know, a week turnaround or a week publication notice period might be reasonable in the context of monthly meetings, but if you're looking at fortnightly meetings, I can imagine that would be driving a huge amount of activity and would be the source of a great deal of stress.
Really, really good point. Tony, have you got a sense of whether there is a standard for that?
There is a huge range, Chris, and I've seen counts. There are councils in Victoria with 14-day provisions, which seems that's probably the outer. Wow. I've seen 10 days, and then and as Kendra has summed up, it really there's a challenge there because you know you want time for councillors to read the materials, you want time for the community to take it in before the meeting, but you know. There's it's such like we present this, you know, little podcast every week, and there's new things for councils every week. So imagine if you're, you know, trying to map out your you know meet your entire meeting agenda a whole 2 or 3 weeks before that point. There's likely to be lots of things come up in the intervening time that are relevant.
All right. Are we happy to leave that there? We've spent a lot of time on that. But as you say, Tony, quite a few things coming out of that report with sector-wide potential repercussions, if you like. And I'm sure the government, LGV, looking at that very closely, considering that we've got conduct reforms that we're yet to see the detail of. I think they include, Tony, a uniform code of conduct that
well
might
they
be
do
required.
That's certainly in the February announcement from government said a uniform councillor code of conduct, but also used language that was sort of and associated or and other changes, and so you know, does that mean a uniform set of governance rules? Does
yeah,
that
I wondered.
Mean other documents that are prescribed for councillors?
Have you got any sense of that, Kendria? What we might see?
Not a sense of where we're headed there, but I certainly know from that if there were to be uniform governance rules, that for I'd be very concerned about the process for developing those, because for some councils that do have, you know, very strong governance rules in place, the moving to a uniform set of governance rules might in fact be a step backwards in the wrong direction. So certainly if that is something that's going to be progressed, then you'd really want to be ensuring that that it is indeed a progression forward towards better practice. And that's very difficult when you have such a base that you're working from with such variability within the sector at present.
Good luck to whoever's making those
yes.
Decisions. Now, we've got a long list of other things that have come up this week, so we might just deal with these briefly, get some comments. A couple of things that caught my eye in the press. A councillor out at Dandenong, this is Councillor Rhonda Garrad, apparently addressed a pro-Palestine rally out the front of a local business that produces parts for fighter jets, I think, that may or may not be used by Israel in the current conflict over there. The owner of the business says she's going to raise a complaint with the local government minister about that councillor's comments and appearance at the rally. The councillor says they were there in a personal capacity. I know this has come up for us before, Tony. Interested in Kendria's thoughts here, in a personal capacity and not as a councillor. Kendria, your first thoughts.
My first thought is that once you're holding a public office, you are never not a councillor.
Yep.
And, you know, of course, This is one of the things that the sector is challenged by on an ongoing basis, and they frequently have policies that give guidance to councillors in making clear that public statements they might be making are not representing a council position, if indeed they are not. But for a councillor to further distinguish and suggest that public activism or public statements that are made are being made as an individual as opposed to as a councillor, I think is an illusion that dissipates fairly quickly because, you know, whilst you hold that public office, it's really not a hat you can take off and put back on. And that's, of course, leaving aside the sensitivity and specifics of this particular issue, but it's yet again another illustration of where this particular the balance that councils try and strike between allowing, of course, the proper expression of free speech and also the need of councils to, you know, manage the council message. You know, this is an illustration of yet again that tension that council administrations and councils are actually grappling with.
Look, I would want to know whether Councillor Garrad, you know, had her council badge on, whether she was, you know, introduced as Councillor Garrad, whether she referred to her position as a councillor when she, you know, held the microphone and spoke. I mean, I believe she's indicated that she didn't do any of those things and she made it clear that she was attending just as an individual. So I think in the context that she hasn't done anything legally wrong, she's you know, just exercised a right to protest, then I think that provided she's as I say, distanced herself from her council position and not held herself out in some way to have a platform here because she is a councillor, then you know, she's got that democratic right. But as Kendry says, councillors always need to be aware when they're being when they're speaking on controversial issues, whether it's on social media or in a public forum, that you know, they are, you know, are they there in their individual capacity? And if so, they need to make that statement. You know, probably something explicit like that. I just want to say that I'm here representing myself, not council. Yeah.
It's a fine line though, isn't it, Tony? Because I think that you know, and there's no suggestion that anything improper has occurred here, but you know, given the platform and the particular attention that is paid to councillors in such sort of, you know, political activism, it's inevitable that in some way the broadcasting of those views is going to be drawing upon their status as a councillor and their role as a councillor, notwithstanding any disclaimers. So it's just one of those, I think things that, you know, councils need to be, as you say, very, very careful of. And I just don't know that the distinction between being an individual and being a councillor can really, you know, be sustained over time. It's a very, very fine line.
Yes, as I think we've discussed at various times in the past, notwithstanding the Dandenong Star Journal report doesn't sort of really say anything to contradict Tony's view that, you know, nothing legally has been done wrong here, unless there's some elements that the complaint contains that we're not aware of. It's pretty hard to see the minister entertaining a complaint of this nature, isn't it, Kendria or Tony?
Yeah, I agree with you, Chris. I don't see any current breach of any standards of conduct.
Yeah.
I would agree. On the information we've been given, absolutely.
Yeah. All right, let's move on. Asbestos contamination we talked about last week, just a quick update. This is changing virtually twice a day, as that's how frequently the EPA is putting their updates on their website. The number of affected sites in Hobsons Bay is now up to 14. The total number of sites inspected, Hobson's Bay says it's 22, the EPA says it's 21, that's a minor matter, but 14 where confirmed asbestos has been found. Investigations are ongoing into where that has come from. There was a site in Casey added this week, Minahans Reserve, which has now been cleaned up and I think just about open to the public again as of now as we record this. Anything new to add on your comments last week, Tony, because you were a bit concerned about the EPA's approach to this, weren't you?
Yeah. Look. Firstly, I feel we need to have a little tally clock in the bottom right-hand corner in our episodes, don't we? How many locations this week? But look, I note that the EPA's given a range of reasons for the asbestos being present on different sites. You know, from historic dumping at some sites to, you know, a legacy of sort of in situ pre-existing contamination in a site through to, you know, nearby building works having contaminated the site. So, you know, a whole range explanations for the presence of asbestos in these sites. Look, they are the experts. I'm still getting my head around their explanation here, but clearly it's a much more widespread problem than we might have initially thought.
Yeah, there was one site in Brimbank, which I think has been dealt with as well.
At Casey Sunshine as well West. Now, yeah.
Yes,
yeah.
The Casey site, Minahans Reserve. You know, Hobson's Bay in particular and parts of Melbourne's West, former industrial area, it's pretty hard to turn a sod there without coming up with some sort of contamination history. History would tell us. Kendri, any observations on how these issues are being dealt with from your point of view?
Well, I'd wonder, Tony, if the tally in the corner might tally up the cost as well. That's what sort of springs to mind for me is the, you know, massive remediation cost that will be incurred and you know, be careful what you sort of look for sometimes. It's of real concern.
All right. As we said last week, keep an eye on the EPA and the Hobson's Bay website in particular for the regular updates on those issues. A new business opening in, or trying to open, in Footscray in the old Franco Cozzo building has made news this week. Probably normally wouldn't bother with this story, but it's got an interesting wrinkle in that the original reports from The Age, Nine News, other media outlets suggested or had the owner suggesting that the opening was cancelled 10 minutes prior due to the council refusing to issue the necessary permissions for that business to open. Maribyrnong City Council has come out and quite clearly said it was nothing to do with them. It was a private building surveyor. There's nothing that they've done that has affected that business's ability to open. I noticed the media has updated their stories, but they're still sort of, it's got a bit of a tinge of disbelief about it, Tony, hasn't it? Like they're not believing what the council's saying here, which
is interesting. We're talking about the Moondog Wild West Brewery. Sounds like somewhere you might hang out, Chris. Sounds like something out of the Blues Brothers to me. You know, imagine bottles
doesn't sound quite my scene, Tony. But yeah,
apparently the party had 600 guests invited. The launch party. Called off at the last minute. And the owners claimed, it was the last minute refusal of Maribyrnong City Council to issue a fire safety permit. But as you say, we find out that in the statement by Celia Haddock, the CEO there, it seems that the brewery's own private building surveyor had declined to issue an occupancy permit, given some concerns about whether works were compliant or not. So it does seem to me that council has been sort of attempted to be made the scapegoat for a stuff up, if you like, amongst some consultants working for this, potentially for this business. But as you say, the reporting, do people just remember the first report that blamed the council, or did they remember the council's rejoinder to that? I suspect that, you know, a bit of mud sticks.
Yeah, Kendria, could this possibly be that people are just not that au fait with how the building permit system works now, because a lot of private building surveyors are involved in spaces where councils traditionally used to be, aren't they?
Absolutely. But I think, you know, there's some fairly lazy reporting going on here too. I mean, these are matters of fact. And I would have thought some more careful questioning by the media could have avoided, you know, the suggestion, if it is indeed incorrect, that this was due to an action by council. And again, I think there's a bit of the media really does have an obligation to do better in this regard and fact check and scrutinise the claims and who knows which way this will fall out. But honestly, the reporting on this is just not terribly helpful, and it's really not. I wouldn't have thought met the standards that should be required, particularly when you're talking about significant sort of statutory obligations and compliance matters. It's a bit disappointing.
Yeah, I agree. I would agree with that. The council statement said the council is disappointed that the cancellation of the opening has been misrepresented by Moondog as being a decision made by council, especially given how closely we've worked with them throughout the planning and construction process. All right, let's go across to Banyul, where a development that the council has agreed to with Woolworths, this is turning an old library in Rosanna into a new facility, community space, a new supermarket. I believe it's the first supermarket in that area, if this goes through. This has been
an IGA or something.
Yeah, fair enough. It's been in the works for a few years, pre-pandemic, slowed down by a lot of things and rising costs, et cetera. The cost has blown out considerably. But some residents here, Tony, are questioning the process behind the decision to proceed in this manner by Banyul Council.
Yeah. So this is, as you say, it's a 1970s era library in Rosanna near the railway station there. There's been a level crossing removal project there. It's sort of transformed that area. That old library is to be demolished, as you say, to make way for this $16.5 million cost library, toy library, community hub, maternal child health type facility. And when it was announced, according to these community members who are concerned, they understood that this would be at no net cost to council, because council was transferring part of the land to Woolworths for their new supermarket, and in return was going to get this new community facility. Well, it's turned out that, look, there is a net cost to council. It's $12.3 million of that $16.5 million cost. There's $2.7 coming from Woolworths. These members of the public say they're being gaslighted because they understood no net cost to council. But look, the budget was revealed at a council meeting this month. There's been a unanimous vote by the councillors to proceed with the project. The mayor, Tom Mellican, has come out and said, you know, this is a great project. It's going to revitalise the Rosanna Shopping Precinct. And I think he's right when he says, you know, it will create a community hub that will serve local people for many years. I tend to agree that once we have one of these new community assets out there, the community will sort of reach their conclusions when they're using the asset. We know these things aren't cheap. And here, at least council's sought to defray some of that cost, if you like, by some element of a land swap arrangement, and it would seem that the cost to councils ultimately perhaps potentially higher than was originally anticipated, but you'd expect that with rising construction costs, etc.
Interesting, and I wonder whether, if you look at the calendar with a few months to go to elections, whether there's political elements at play here. Tony, care to comment? Probably. You don't have to comment on that. Just a cynical observation on my part. We might leave that one there. The Age has reported that this week. A few other notes of interest. a governance veteran of 30 years in the sector at councils like Darebin and Yarra. Rhys Thomas has been announced as the new head of local government programs and policy at the VLGA. Now, Rhys, I know, has been a long-term listener and supporter of the governance update, and he's joining the family, Tony.
Yeah, you got a unique background, Rhys. As you say, 30 years in local government, but also I think you've got qualifications in planning and has worked in private industry as, I think, traffic engineering planning. He's got a law degree as well. So, and he's, as I've worked with Rhys at other, at various councils, and he'll be a great find for VLGA, and I think will make a significant contribution.
Good move. Kendria, I think it's great to see people with real local government experience actually taking on roles like these in the peak bodies, because I know that's been a challenge in the past, hasn't it?
Oh, absolutely. I don't know Rhys, but hi, Rhys. So if you're a watcher, then he'll be watching this episode.
And I bet he'll be watching this one just on the off chance that we might talk about that appointment, which everyone thinks is a pretty great appointment. A couple of stories out of Tasmania. We don't need to spend a lot of time on this, but these are just fascinating, seeing the latest come through on these. At La Trobe Council, where they're recruiting a GM, the mayor has been accused of threatening colleagues with jail terms, basically, over release of confidential information or the potential release. He's refuted those claims quite strongly. Another councillor has now turned to a statutory declaration to say that he absolutely said the comments she's claimed that he did. So that's playing out while they're trying to recruit a GM. What about the look to whoever the final, I think they're down to one candidate. Wouldn't you be looking at this and thinking, do I really want this job?
Yeah, I think, it seems to me it's a case of councillors sort of not putting the best interests of the community and council first, but rather, their own sort of internal agendas and airing all that in public. I don't see what the net benefit of this is, other than furthering some personal agendas of various councillors. I think the difference in opinion, I suspect, or the difference in view of the facts, might come right down to just a little whether it was a typo or a misstatement about a date, which I think might allow people to say, no, that didn't happen.
Right.
Someone else saying it did when there was an error on a date, I suspect, if you read the fine detail of this.
Yeah, two separate dates being offered as to when those supposedly confidential discussions happened. And another one, Kendria, out of the who would really want to be a council CEO stroke a GM file from Central Highlands Council, where the general manager's performance review is overdue, and it's at the centre of a bit of a war between the mayor of that council and the rest of the councillors by the looks of things. Those councillors called a meeting to deal with it. The mayor was not happy and has accused them of corruption and collusion because of it.
Because the mayor's come out and said, it's corruption and collusion, or at least that's reportedly come out and said that.
Yeah.
And said, look, these councillors couldn't partake on a professional level in an independent review of the GM because she's observed that they had acted in a way showing a personal attachment to the GM.
Yeah.
But then subsequently there's been a motion passed at council, I think 7-2, for the mayor to withdraw her accusations and publish a notice to that effect. Now, it seems the mayor's walked it back a little in that the mayor's said, she's reaffirmed that she thinks that this special meeting to discuss the CEO performance review, she says that was a waste of money, but she says, I wasn't accusing anyone of collusion or corruption. I was really referring to that as a possibility because of the secrecy element. Wow. So I think the mayor's walking this back fairly quickly, but yeah, it's a pretty difficult situation for the senior officer to be in, and wouldn't encourage one to apply for a role at that game.
No, and just another in a long line of examples of where CEO or general manager positions get caught up in the political elements of councils around the country, and I think just make those roles unnecessarily more complicated than they need to be.
And it probably also highlights the rationale behind there being more formal structures being brought into the management of the CEO relationship. So, including in the 2020 Act in Victoria, councillors sometimes forget that they need to operate as a council in managing the employment relationship with the CEO. It's never helpful, and is in fact quite destructive when councillors are working as individuals and dragging a CEO or a GM in you know 7 or 9 or 11 different directions. You know, they really need to work as a body corporate, and really the mayor in that instance needs to be managing that relationship very tightly, so that both the planning for the CEO and the assessment of their performance is really rigorously managed, so that the CEO is not caught in an invidious situation where the different actors are working independent of one another. So it certainly is a case in point, I suppose, for having much tighter management of that relationship.
Very, very well said. Now, before we wrap up, just a quick peek across the border and then another border into Queensland, where they've had elections last month. We've now had 4 council CEOs as of today resign as a direct result of the new council. At least that's what it appears reading between the lines. There might be one exception, the CEO of Brisbane. There might be some other reasons there, but Townsville is the latest on that list as these new councils start to take over and impose their mandates, as they would call them, for their communities. A couple of things that have arisen in the last week of note. At Cairns, questions about a $19,000 spend on a mayoral induction ceremony, which has normally apparently been very low-key, but this was a big event that they spent nearly $20,000 on, and that's gotten some attention in the media. And an embarrassing mistake at Brisbane, Tony, where one simple reference was left out of the oath that the, I think, 26 councillors took, and they had to do a do-over meeting the next week. That is not a good look.
No, it's not a good look. The Lord Mayor Adrian Schrinner said it was an inexcusable mistake by the CEO. I suspect it's just likely an error by a governance officer, etc. I don't think it's a regrettable error, but I think it's easily solvable, as you know. But I think it's a salutary reminder right now for CEOs and governance officers looking forward to the elections at the end of the year. You know, go and look at the local governance and integrity regulations. It's Reg 5, and it's published there, exactly the 3 paragraphs of words that a councillor must read out, and don't leave a sentence out.
No, and some of us have learnt that the hard way. That's a chapter I don't want to relive, when a similar thing happened in Victoria a few years back.
I was thinking, Chris, of exactly those instances that did occur in Victoria in the past. But, you know, for me, whilst the reporting, again, I think, you know, the media is focusing on the mistake that was made, and there's some suggestion that it was, that this is an outrageous mistake. I think for me what jumps out is not that, but the overall sort of regulatory regime and the prescriptiveness of that regime that local governments work within. Because there are many, you know, far more serious infractions that can be committed within the bounds of local government regulation that seemingly have no consequence and have no remedy. And yet you can have an inadvertent error of such a seemingly minor nature, you know, having such serious consequences, including calling into question the validity of decisions that have been made since the imperfect ceremony was held. And fortunately, in that case, they found the error early on, because you can imagine if this had occurred, or this error had been uncovered 2 years down the track, and if it did indeed call into question the validity of all those subsequent council decisions, you'd be you'd be in a world of trouble then.
Very true.
You know, I just wonder about the calibration of the regulatory regime when such minor things have such significant consequences. Yeah. And yet others don't. So
It's an interesting point. Would be interested to know who realised about the mistake so quickly. And as you say, they're able to deal with it within a couple of days. I think they made a few decisions just post the swearing in that they were then concerned wouldn't have any validity. And what about spending nearly $20,000 on a mural induction ceremony?
I reckon that's the biggest story for me. I think that's a big misread of public, public opinion. It sounds a bit out of touch to me, particularly in the context. I mean, apparently Cairns Regional Council has a very significant debt to eight figures, and that this particular mayor, Councillor Eden, in her campaign materials ran on greater fiscal responsibility. So, I just think that mayor would want to hope that the public don't have long memories in 4 years hence. I think that $19,000 seems like a lot of money for a show with 450 onlookers at the Cairns Performing Arts Centre to induct the mayor seems like a big expense to me.
You wonder what the money went on. Mm-hmm. Surely that's not all catering.
Hire the hall, you know.
Yeah,
security
in a council facility. Anyway, we're only guessing and speculating. We might leave it on that note. Any final thoughts, Kendria? Firstly, I ask you on the week's news or what might be ahead.
Well, I think this last story is actually of particular interest because, you know, certainly for me it isn't just a story about the cost. It's actually raises for me a whole lot of questions around the ceremony and the conduct of such ceremonies in this day and age, because in many respects some of those ceremonies appear to be anachronistic, and I understand the perspective of councillors who like to uphold the tradition and like to don the robes and hand over the gavel and present the chains and go through all that ceremony, but I do wonder as to, you know, whether that is actually reflective of a contemporary local government practice, and I think in some areas that might actually be not suitable and not really very reflective of and connected to the community that the position is meant to represent.
A lot of councils have moved away from robes and chains, yes, haven't they? It would be interesting to know what the balance is, how many are still hanging on to those traditions from the past. Tony, final words from you?
Well, I'll be working through my inbox. I got an interesting email just the last night from IBAC. So I've been asked to fill out that survey on perceptions of public sector corruption. So I'll have a play with that on the weekend.
How long do you think that will take you?
Well, I think they say it's going to take me 15, 20 minutes, but it'd be interesting. It's certainly an initiative by IBAC to gather information across more than just local government, across broadly across the public sector about perceptions of corruption, whether be that in procurement, in appointments, in it's great, I think, that they're reaching out to people who are engaging with the sector and would have some experience in procurement. Yeah. So that'll be a bit of fun for me on the weekend.
Good luck with that, Tony. We did say that was coming last week. Quick plug for the Standing for Local Government sessions that the VLGA is running on the 17th of May and the Local Women Leading Change session on the 24th of May. And a reminder to CEOs who may be listening from VLGA member councils that the VLGA's Election 2024 Candidate Training Program prospectus is now available. It's got stacks of information on how your council can work with the VLGA to offer tailored workshops for potential candidates, as we're about to hit, I think, the 6 month mark. I think it might be next week, 6 months to election day in Victoria. Gosh, it's coming around quickly, isn't it? Tony, thank you as always to you and the team at Hunt & Hunt Lawyers for your support for TGU and for your insights. Particularly great to hear your take on the Glenelg report, which is available on the Local Government Local Government Victoria website now. We'll talk to you next week. And Kendria Pope, lovely to have you. Thank you for stepping in for Julie this week, and we hope we'll be able to see some more of you in future on TGU.
Thank you, Chris. It's been interesting as always.
Absolutely. All right. That's TGU for this week from VLGA Connect. Thank you so much for watching and listening, and we'll see you again very soon.